Honey, have you seen my tennis shoes? I have a Pilates class in 20 minutes.
They're over here by your yoga mat.
Mom, Dad, don't forget, I need to take my DHA supplements.
Oh, that's right. Thanks for reminding us.
Yeah, I need to take mine too. Could you stop by the health food store on your way home? I'd like some raw almonds and cashews for the game tomorrow. This is the Internet Talk Radio Show dedicated to the health of you and your family. Healthy Family Talk Radio. Available all day, every day. Now, here's your host, Kerry St. Louis.
Honey, I feel a bit overwhelmed.
Why's that?
Well, we're so busy and I worry that the kids aren't getting the proper nutrition they need, not to mention us.
I always thought we ate pretty well.
We do, but there's more we should be doing, like taking quality organic herbs and nutritional supplements. I'd really like to stick to natural products, too.
I'll do a search on the internet. Maybe we'll find something there.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Searching for the best natural supplements? Your search is over. Just point your browser to MapleCreekNaturals.com. You'll find quality organic herbs and an array of nutritional supplements like DHA and more, all with a great taste, so you can easily give your family the nutritional supplements they need, even your pets. Stop searching and check it out today. MapleCreekNaturals.com. That's all one word, MapleCreekNaturals.com. Your search for the best organic herbs and nutritional supplements is over. MapleCreekNaturals.com.
Today, I have Amy Lansky from ImpossibleCure.com. Welcome, Amy.
Hi. Nice to be here, Carrie.
It's nice to have you. I read your article in the Mothering magazine, and I thought it was a very, very fascinating story. So, why did you write The Impossible Cure, and who is your audience?
Okay, I wrote the book to let people in general, really the general population, know about homeopathy, about the amazing curative powers of homeopathy. And in particular, you know, there's many cure stories in my book, first-person, you know, stories of healing in the book, but one of the primary ones, a whole chapter is devoted to the story of how my son, Max, was cured of autism with homeopathy, and many of your listeners probably know about, have heard about the autism epidemic that's happening now. And that was my first experience of homeopathy, was my son being cured. So it was like very life-transforming, amazing experience. And so I started studying homeopathy myself, and gave up my previous career and decided to write this book to let people know about that, but also about homeopathy. So my book, this book, Impossible Cure, is really a general introduction to homeopathy. In fact, it's used even as a first-year textbook at the schools, but it's like one of the primary patient education books. But it also has a chapter about my son's cure from autism, so it's very popular in the autism community too.
So what do you believe is causing the autism epidemic?
Well, you know, this is, it's a controversial subject, but actually within the autism community, within the community of parents, it's not that controversial. Most parents, including myself, believe that the primary cause is from vaccine damage. This obviously is not something the vaccine manufacturers or even the government want people to believe, but it's a sad fact that it probably is the case. In fact, there's a lot of evidence of this. If you just look at the incidence rates of autism over the past 50 years, like the curve of when it like suddenly would shoot up, and the changes in the rates occurred directly corresponding to when various vaccines were introduced into the childhood pediatric protocol. For example, the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, and also when the hepatitis B vaccine was introduced into the protocol, which was in the early 1990s, was a huge jump in autism rates. So now some people think it's the thimerosal in the vaccines, which is a mercury preservative in the vaccines. And personally, I believe, and you know, there's also evidence for this, that it's a mixture of factors. It's the fact that there's mercury in many of the vaccines, and also the fact that more and more vaccines are given. So in combination, the mercury kind of sensitizes the children to having an autoimmune reaction to all these different antigens that are pumped into kids all at once. Like often on many appointments you're getting, you know, up to like 10 different disease factors, you know, in one appointment. So it's just so much, you know, I'm 50 years old compared to what we were getting, I was getting as a child. It's like many, many times more disease factors and many, many more, you know, vaccinations, inoculations are given.
Mm-hmm. And they do them so close together, too.
Right. Just one after the other and many at once. Like, you know, one appointment you might get measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, Haemophilus influenza B, polio, and hepatitis B, you know, all like, you know, thrown in at once on the same appointment. And some of them have mercury in them.
Right.
And I've heard people say that, like, the amount of mercury, you know, mercury is a cumulative thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like many, many times the safe standard, you know, according to the horrible thing that's been done to sort of a generation of kids. And now they're beginning to, some states have outlawed the thimerosal in the vaccines. Nevertheless, some vaccines still have it in, like the flu vaccine does have it in there. But in the states like California where I am, where they've outlawed it a couple years ago, the autism rates have started to level off instead of increasing. They were increasing by an enormous rate. Like going up, you know, 400%, I think it was 400%, like in between 1990 and 2000, something like that. And then it doubled again in the next 4 years. It just unbelievable. So it's starting to level off now that they're removing. But it's still there, you know, it's not like it's going
right,
away.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And don't doctors use, don't they finish the old vaccines before they bring in the new, even though they have the old ones
right.
in stock?
Right. So there's even though they may outlaw it, they're still using up the old stock. And I also heard that they often create a new stock from, like when they're mixing it up or whatever,
uh-huh.
they use an old stock to create the new stock. So
oh,
there
my.
May be some remnants of the old stock in the new stock.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, is there a way a parent can make sure that they get a new stock, do you know?
Right. Well, you know, I've heard many stories. First of all, you should definitely, if you are going to vaccinate, you know, I recommend all parents educate themselves
mm-hmm.
about vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a hard thing to do. You have to really go out of your way and look at the websites. The one I recommend is the National Vaccine Information Center website, which is 909shot.com. That's probably one of the primary ones.
Right.
And you should ask your doctor to see the actual packaging.
Right.
Because a lot of times they'll say, oh, no, it's not there. But then when you look, it is there. Mm-hmm. I've heard so many stories like that.
They have lot numbers.
Yeah, there's lot numbers you can, and it should actually say on the packaging what the preservatives are in there. And there's also various ways, I mean, if you're going to vaccinate, to make it safer. The first thing that you should always know, and, you know, no matter what your doctor says, you should never vaccinate your kid if they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard many stories of you know, a kid who's sick. And I think that was the case with my son. He had been sick. I had postponed the appointment when he had his MMR vaccine, and he had had roseola. And I think he was still kind of getting over it when he was vaccinated for measles.
Mm.
And that's the one that I suspect, and that's often the one that's implicated in autism.
Right.
So never, even if your kid's remotely sick, don't vaccinate. Another thing that you can try to do is to spread it out. Don't give all of them at once. You know, you don't have to stay on this schedule. You can make more appointments and go
right.
in and spread them out. Try to postpone them as long as possible. In some countries, they won't even vaccinate a kid before they're 2 years old because mm-hmm. they think it's too dangerous.
I've heard of some parents having some challenges with their doctors spreading them out. And I personally think that some of the doctors, it's more convenient for them to do it, you know.
Right. It's a convenience factor, and they like you to stay on the schedule because then it kind of gets you keep coming into the doctor's office.
Right, right.
But if you're, you know, your first priority should be your kid. And if you want to do this, then you should do it more safely. Another thing that's very harder to do, but is possible, is, you know, there are several trivalent vaccines, you know, MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, and it's possible but difficult to get the individual, get a measles vaccine,
right,
a mumps vaccine. It's harder to, might have to special order it or whatever, but it also avoids giving several different times, you know. So all of that would make it safer, but still it's probably, you know, there's risks, and you should educate yourself.
Right. Gosh, we could talk all day about vaccines.
Yes, yeah. And I
could just say a whole lot more than what I'm saying now.
Yeah.
So back to homeopathy. So how can homeopathy cure autism?
Well, that's a good question. And you know, Max is not the only case. I mean, I'm hearing of, you know, because of my book, many, many parents write to me, and both people have tried homeopathy and it's helped their kid, and also parents that I write to me, and then I give them a referral to a homeopath, and then they write back to me and tell me how their child is progressing. So I know there's many more cases of children being cured besides my son. Well, you know, homeopathy has a long history of repairing vaccine damage. That's number one. It's a therapy that has a long history of treating chronic ailments. So, you know, the various kinds, including, you know, chronic ailments that originated in vaccine damage. In fact, I mean, it has a history, you know, 100-year-old history of that since the beginning of the very first vaccinations, these smallpox vaccinations, I think, which began in the late 1800s, something like that. So that's one thing. But, you know, homeopathy is an individualized medicine. It's not like, here's autism, give this remedy. You know, treatment is completely individualized based on the symptoms of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And so a child will come to the homeopath, and although many autistic kids have similar symptoms, each one is usually very unique or has some unique pattern of symptoms or sensitivities or, you know, whatever, or even etiology, even what vaccine they think damaged them or whatever. And so the homeopath will look at those symptoms, and really homeopathy is able to treat any ailment if a remedy can be found that matches the symptoms that the person is experiencing. So we can discuss that more, how homeopathy works in general.
Is there a particular homeopathic remedy for autism?
Well, like I said, okay, it's a very individualized treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have 10 autistic kids, that could be 10 different remedies. Now, what I advocate is classical homeopathy. So this is finding one remedy that matches the child, the symptoms of the child the best, and just giving this one remedy. And over a period of years, there might be several different remedies used, but at each particular time, just one remedy. There's other methods of homeopathic treatment I know that are out there that are based on ideas. For example, if you know that your child was damaged by a particular vaccine, you can give a potentized or a homeopathic preparation of that vaccine. Can sometimes undo the damage.
Mm-hmm.
And that methodology actually can work. It really depends on the symptoms of the kid. And most classical homeopaths will do that if it's necessary. But I always advocate starting with, you know, completely classical methodology first, and maybe using techniques like that if they're needed. So that's another approach. It's called isopathy, where if you suspect that a particular substance has caused damage, doesn't have to be a vaccine, it can be something else, you know, some kind of drug reaction or whatever, you give that substance what we say in potency, which is this homeopathically prepared version of it, which is very extremely diluted.
Right.
I can discuss that, but so.
Now, I have heard of homeopathic vaccines.
Right.
Is this what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Some people call that. So some people, that's another approach. Some people, now this is definitely not classical homeopathy, but there's people in Australia, this one guy in Australia who advocates a methodology of, let's say you don't want to give the regular vaccines, of giving the vaccines in potency like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that method is also used to correct the vaccine damage as well.
Okay.
It's kind of confusing.
Right.
I personally don't know anything about whether, you know, giving the vaccines in potency is effective in preventing the disease. There's a more classical form of disease prevention than that. So I don't usually advocate that people do that, like give, let's say, DPT in potency, homeopathic DPT instead of the vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
If you ended up getting, you know, measles, there's other remedies that are much more commonly used to treat measles, not the measles vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, yeah, I definitely wouldn't advocate that. Anyway, you know, if people read my book, I do discuss all of this in kind of
detail.
Oh,
that's great. Okay.
Yeah.
So what other conditions can be treated with homeopathy?
Well, you know, I always say pretty much anything. You know, if there is some possibility that the body can repair itself, then homeopathy has the potential to cure. So the only disease I've never heard of somebody having cured is type 1 diabetes, in which case, you know, pancreas is just, you know, completely, you know, not able to be repaired anymore. So, you know, in a case where, like, your organ is missing or, you know, just completely damaged and there's no chance that your body can repair itself, then I don't think homeopathy can cure it. But, you know, for most chronic ailments, in my book there's descriptions of cures from all the way from, like, chronic bladder infections to migraines and emotional problems like anxiety disorder. There's an amazing Alzheimer's case in my book that's just mind-boggling, actually. To, you know, just the flu and, like, my own, for example, I have some examples from my own family. Like, in my own case, I used to have severe summer allergies, and those completely disappeared once I started being treated homeopathically.
Oh, yeah.
Just a wild, and even very severe diseases, too, even serious infections, and there's a heart attack case in the book. So, you know, there's definitely a place for modern medicine, but there's also room for homeopathy to really help as well. So
for those listeners who don't know what homeopathy is there a way you can explain it in a nutshell? What is homeopathy?
Okay, well, homeopathy, the word homeopathy actually explains what it is. So the word homeo means similar, and the word pathy means suffering. So it means similar suffering. And so basically there's a single rule in homeopathy that determines what substance you give to a person to cure them. And it's called the law of similars, and it says if you are suffering, if a substance can cause a set of symptoms, then it can also cure those symptoms. That's the law of similars. So let's give you an example. We all know that, like, what coffee does to people, it makes people very alert and happy and excited and awake, like that kind of state. So if you are, let's say, suffering from insomnia, a particular kind of insomnia, because there's many different patterns of insomnia, but let's say it's the kind of insomnia where you're very alert and your mind is full of thoughts and you're excited and happy and can't fall asleep, let's say, like, after a party, something like that, that's a time when a homeopathically prepared coffee is actually the correct remedy for that kind of insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
Because coffee can cause this, it can also cure it. Now, I'm not saying you should drink a cup of coffee. So that's the other part of homeopathy, is the way the medicines are prepared. So let's say you wanted to create homeopathically prepared coffee. What's done is that it's the substance, let's say a coffee bean, is diluted. It could be a liquid, or it can be diluted in a milk sugar. That's the other way it's done, so in a powder. So it's diluted and shaken up and diluted and shaken up. So let's say you're going to prepare something from a flower. You take a tincture of the flower, you start with that, and you, let's say, take one drop of that and mix it with 100 drops of water. Then you shake it up, and then you take a drop of that and then mix it up with another 100 drops of water and shake it up. So it becomes very, very dilute very quickly. Now, that's also the controversial part about homeopathy, because conventional medicine and chemistry says there's nothing in there, right?
Right.
It's been so diluted. But there's more and more evidence, and I discuss this in my book, that there is something, that it isn't simply water, that there is something going on, there's essentially an energy embedded in this dilution.
Mm-hmm.
There's evidence, even there's more and more actually scientific evidence that these dilutions have medicinal power, like they can have the effects that the original substance had, even though if you looked in a microscope, you might not find them, even a molecule of the original substance. Mm-hmm. That dilution can still have the same effects. It's also, though, what makes homeopathic remedies non-toxic, because the original substance isn't there. It's not working biochemically. It's working sort of in an energy level.
Right.
So it's like an energy medicine, the same way acupuncture is an energy medicine.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I was in naturopathic school, they taught us, they didn't touch too much on homeopathy, but they taught us that we were supposed to succuss the container with the homeopathic remedy in it. Is that
right? So the succussion means the shaking,
right? To get the energy.
Right. You see, when Hahnemann, who's the founder of homeopathy, he was a German physician in the 1800s, and he was also a chemist, and he first realized the principle of the law of similars, and then at first he was giving these substances just in regular form. Let's say if he was, giving this flower, he would actually give the actual tincture of the flower. But then often he was using very toxic substances. People were using them, like mercury, for example. And so he wanted to lessen the toxic effects, so he started diluting it. And then he found, well, if he diluted it too much, it didn't work. Then he decided he would mix it up through this process of shaking,
mm-hmm.
much better, and then he suddenly found it was working. Now, in modern experiments, there's a French scientist named Jacques Benveniste. He actually died last year, but he was nominated for like a Nobel Prize, and he's an MD. He was an allopathic doctor, researcher. And he was experimenting with this, and he found, too, that unless you do the shaking, it doesn't work. So somehow the process of shaking and the diluting is what somehow does this energy transfer.
Okay.
So it's very important. Yeah, it's a very important
thing. Because I'm always shaking. I mean, I'm always shaking the bottles, the Highlands. I get those little tablets, and I'm always shaking.
Oh, you even shake it with the tablets.
I do.
Yeah, I don't even know if that does anything, but I got to admit I do it myself.
It's a habit. But
yeah.
So parents that get homeopathic remedies, they need to understand that they need to shake it before they give it to their child? Or
dilution, yes, it's shaken.
Okay.
If the dilution is done using powders, then it's done by grinding instead of shaking. Ground together.
Because a lot of these tablets are getting powdered.
Yeah.
I'm getting more powder in the container now. The tablets are all shaken.
yeah. No, it's not really necessary. Although I often shake it up too, because the way, like, let's say you get a bunch of these little pellets, the way the pellets are medicated is usually a liquid is a drop of, you know, a few drops of liquid are put into the container with the pellets.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps to shake it up to make sure all the pellets have some of the liquid on them.
Okay.
So that's another reason to shake them.
Now, can you explain real quick what the difference is between 6X and 30X?
Okay. So, okay, there's various different kinds of potencies. But the main two ones that you see in the United States are X and C.
Right.
Like if you go to the... So what X means is that each step of dilution is 1 to 10. So one drop of the original to 10 drops of water, let's say. Okay. A C means the dilution is 1 to 100. Because like C in, you know, in Latin letters is 100 and X is 10. If you know your... what is it? Roman numerals, right?
Right.
So 6X, let's say, is it's diluted 1 to 10 six times. So it's essentially a dilution of 10 to the sixth, which is a million. Okay. A 30X is 1 to the 10th dilution 30 times. So that's 10 to the 30th. Now, at that point, you're beyond Avogadro's number, which is the point at which, you know, 1 to 100 six times. And that's the same as 10 to the 12th. So
mm-hmm.
I used to be a computer scientist, so I know all this math stuff. But
well, I heard what I want to look for in the tablet form,
mm-hmm.
not the pellet form, but the tablet form is the 6X.
Now, it doesn't – I personally always use C's myself.
Right. Those are the pellets, right?
No. You can get C's or X's in pellet or tablet form. They're all the same. It's just how the pharmacy – manufactures it.
Okay.
But it doesn't make a difference. No.
Okay.
I mean, because I've bought C's in tablet form and X's in pellet form, and, you know, some pharmacies make them in pellet form, some making them in tablet form. So it's just what it looks like. It doesn't make a difference. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, 30X and 6X, I get so confused sometimes because I'm looking for apis, you know, for, like, bee stings or bite
mm-hmm.
stings. You know, it's like, well, how do you know what you want?
That's a good question. Well,
in the health food store, they don't really know.
Yeah.
I mean, they just have it out on their shelf.
Yeah. In general, a higher potency, and that means a higher number, so 30X is a higher potency than a 6X. The higher the potency, the stronger it is.
Right.
So, and the less frequently you usually take it.
Okay.
And an X is kind of lower than the C as well, because it's 1 to 10 instead of 1 to 100. So the
okay.
more dilute, the more powerful. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? So if you have a bee sting, you know, if it's a very acute situation, or if somebody's very sick, unless they're like an elderly person, like sometimes people who are very elderly, you don't want to give them very high potencies. It's too shocking to their
mm-hmm.
system. But so you might use lower potencies. But if a bee sting, I might give, you know, like a 30C or a 30X if that's what you have.
Okay.
Or if you start with a 6, it might not be enough. You might have to take it more frequently. So often a very safe course is to start with a lower potency, and then if that doesn't help, then go higher.
Right. Okay.
Gosh, yeah.
I feel like I'm in school all over again.
Yeah.
Oh, I could talk for days.
Yeah.
Okay, so is there proof that homeopathy actually works?
Well, you know, I refer people to my book because, you know, before I got into all this, before this happened with my son, you know, I have a PhD in computer science, and so I was sort of a scientist, and I was very interested in these issues as well. So the longest chapter in my book has various medical studies and scientific studies. So there's, contrary to what most doctors think, if they actually explore and look at the literature, there is a lot of studies and more being done every year, medical studies showing that homeopathy does work and that it is not the placebo effect, which is what doctors will say.
Mm-hmm.
So So there's more and more studies being done every year, a lot of them in Europe, because in Europe homeopathy is much more accepted, used much more widely, even by, you know, medical doctors will use homeopathic remedies. there was a study, actually, a study just came out like a couple months ago. It was done at the Bristol Hospital in England, showing that something like, it was a big study, that 75% or something of homeopathic patients had significant improvement with their chronic ailments. It was a larger study with like many people. And there was also a big German study with like thousands of patients that was very successful, a broad range one. But there's like, you know, very specific studies done too on various things like allergies or diarrhea. There was a study done by a doctor from Seattle, Jennifer Jacobs, who did a replicated study. She did this study in Nicaragua and then replicated it in Nepal with childhood diarrhea, which is a very severe problem in third world countries,
mm-hmm.
and found that the remedies that were selected, and this was a double-blind placebo-controlled study, you know, had significant impact on the course of the disease over, like, over nothing, over essentially placebo. Yes, there is proof. And then there's another section in my book that discusses how it possibly could work, and I talk, and, you know, we don't know for sure how it works, even though we know it does work. And
right.
that's true, by the way, of lots of modern medicine. We know things work, but we don't know how they work exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's true even, you know, of many techniques doctors use. But there's inklings in physical chemistry, in the field of physical chemistry, and ultra-dilution physics, indicating sort of clues about how it might be working. I mean, I think in the next 50 years we might really start to understand more how this could be working, but we don't know exactly yet.
Do you think the doctors want us to know?
Well, you know, there's a long history of acrimony between homeopaths and allopaths. You know, homeopathy was a major form of medicine in the 1800s,
mm-hmm.
and the AMA was formed in the 1800s as mostly to try to combat the growing popularity of homeopathy. Homeopathy came to the United States in like the 1830s, and most of the people who were practicing homeopathy in the 1800s were doctors who left conventional medicine to practice homeopathy because it was highly successful in treating a variety of epidemics. That was how it really spread. So it was successful in these cholera epidemics, smallpox epidemics, in the 1800s, and so more and more doctors were practicing it, and they were very alarmed. And so, and actually, at the turn of the century, there was a sort of concerted campaign with the rise of the pharmaceutical companies. There was a campaign between the AMA and the pharmaceutical companies to get rid of homeopathy as well as lots of other forms of alternative medicine, like eclectic medicine, which naturopathy is sort of the descendant of eclectic medicine,
mm-hmm.
which was another branch of medicine. So this whole history is actually discussed in my book, too. My book really covers all these topics.
Oh, great.
Where was I? So, yes, there is a long history of this, and even though most doctors don't remember that history, it's still there. And I think that, you know, I think some doctors actually would, you know, maybe embrace homeopathy. More and more doctors who are becoming homeopaths in my own classes that I've taken in my
mm-hmm.
studies. There's always been several doctors in our classes who just, you know, if they're sincere and they really want to help people, then they realize, you know, this really is amazing stuff. And so, you know, there are many MD homeopaths,
mm-hmm.
but it's still, for most doctors, it's almost too much for them to deal with, because many of the philosophical concepts behind homeopathy are sort of in direct opposition to what doctors are doing.
Right.
And in particular, you know, most medicine is what we call suppressive. It's just suppressing symptoms. And homeopaths believe that suppressive medicine is dangerous.
It is.
So for a doctor to become a homeopath is to sort of admit that what they've been doing and what the medicines they give people are actually often harmful for the people. So that's, you know, it's a big leap mm-hmm. for most of. But I think in their heart, many doctors realize this as well. So when they start learning about homeopathy and they read, you know, when they start learning, they, many of them have this kind of what we call like a conversion experience,
right,
where they realize, oh my God, you know, this is really true, and then they can become excellent homeopaths,
right,
because they also have a lot of medical training, which is really helpful as well. So
what is the relationship between herbalism, naturopathy, Bach flower remedies,
right,
and homeopathy?
Yeah, and that's really confusing for people, because in the modern media, the word homeopathy is often used just as sort of a catch-all for natural medicine, which it's not. It's a specific type of therapy. You're a naturopath. I mean, naturopaths are sort of this grab bag. You know, they're trained in a lot of different therapies. Mm-hmm. So a naturopath does herbalism and homeopathy and, you know, hydrotherapy and various things, you know.
Exactly.
Homeopathy is just the use of these remedies according to the law of similars, these little pellets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's homeopathy. Herbalism is the use of plant tinctures, right? And according to whatever rules that these herbalists use, usually it's folklore and, you know, experience. Mm-hmm. Whereas homeopathy, medicines are given according to this specific law of similars. And also homeopathic remedies are made from a wide variety of substances, not just plants, so animals and, like you said, apis is made from a bee, and also minerals and even, you know, substances, for example, like, you know, vaccines or, you know, disease made from diseases or from body organs and things like that. So, yeah, homeopathic remedy can be made from any substance in nature. So, and there was, oh, Bach flower remedies. You know, Bach was a homeopath.
Right.
And but then he kind of went off on his own. He sort of had some kind of mystical experience, and he felt he could understand the healing properties of these specific flowers. And so the way they're prepared, though, is different than homeopathic remedies. So they're not really homeopathic remedies. Although if you look on the bottle, it sort of says a homeopathic, says something like that. But they're prepared differently. I believe that, like, the flower is floated on the water in the sun or something.
In the sun and then the sun.
Yeah, so it's really different. It's different than the way the remedies are made.
Right, yeah.
And they're not given according to the law of similars.
Mm-hmm.
It's according to Bach's intuition about these flowers. And that's not to say that, actually, I think they are a useful form of medicine. I mean, I use, you know, rescue remedy myself,
yeah.
But it's not a homeopathic remedy.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I'm a big rescue fan myself.
Yes,
and crabapple.
It's very helpful. Yeah.
So how are homeopathic remedies chosen for a patient?
Right. So, you know, I'll tell you, when you go to a homeopath, and here I'm talking about a classical homeopath, which is what I advocate.
Mm-hmm.
They do not use machines or anything like that for testing. It's all based on an oral interview. You go and you usually talk to a homeopath for like an hour or even 2 hours for the first appointment. And you basically tell them your everything, you know, all your physical symptoms and all your emotional and mental symptoms, which are so often the most important symptoms, and you just like your whole life story. And from all that information, they're gathering symptoms, mental, emotional, physical, behavioral symptoms, and even observations about you, too. And then they take that information. Now, each remedy is also associated with, you know, hundreds of symptoms. So it's all a matter of pattern matching, finding which one of the remedy's symptoms is the best match to you. And so it's pretty hard, actually. You know, with experience, homeopaths kind of get to know what the most important symptoms are. And I mean, that's what homeopathic training is all about. It takes years to become a good homeopath. And we also use computers.
Mm-hmm.
figuring out the remedy that best matches you. Now, the way we find out what symptoms are associated with each remedy is by doing these experiments called provings, which are essentially drug trials where usually homeopaths have taken these substances themselves and seen what symptoms they cause. So,
oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
Yes. So, and what's interesting is that, you know, these drug trials, these provings have been done for the past, since the time of Hahnemann,
mm-hmm.
for the past 200 years. And all this information has just been accumulated and stored in these books and now on computers. And but it doesn't change. Unlike, you know, our drugs today, one year this drug is used and the next year it's dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's not used for the same thing anymore. In homeopathy, the same remedies are used for the same things for all time because these substances were given to healthy people, volunteers, usually homeopaths as part of their training, and they marked down what symptoms they caused in them and those are the symptoms that those remedies will be used for.
So I have the book called the Materia Medica.
Materia Medica.
Yeah. Is that how that book was all put together by all these provings? And
right, that's right. So a materia medica, I mean, this is a term, it's sort of an old-fashioned term used by even allopaths, too.
Uh-huh.
It just means a book of medicines. And the materia medica is a book that has a bunch of remedies in it, and for each one it's like a little chapter of all the symptoms that medicine is used for, but those are also the symptoms that medicine causes in approving.
Right.
And so you might go through the book, it might be, if it's a big remedy, a very common remedy, it might have 5-10 pages of information ranging from emotional to headache symptoms, stomach symptoms, eye symptoms, nose, bowel symptoms, period, your menstrual period, just...
It's a thick book.
Every part of your body, a materia medica can be 1,000 pages long,
Right.
And then there's a different kind of book called a repertory,
mm-hmm.
which is the opposite, which is you look up a symptom, let's say you look up a particular kind of sore throat on the left side of your throat that looks like this. You find the symptom and then you see all the remedies that have that symptom. So it's like an index into
mm-hmm.
the materia medica. So those are the main tools we homeopaths use, the materia medica and a repertory. Although now it's also on the computer.
Now you're a homeopath and you're located in California.
Right, right.
Is homeopathy legal in California?
Well, as of beginning of 2003, yes, homeopaths can practice legally in California. There's and every other kind of, alternative medicine. So there's a whole movement in the United States called the Health Freedom Movement, which is trying to find ways for alternative practitioners to practice legally, even if they're not licensed. A lot of people are confused because they don't understand the difference between a license and certification.
Right.
And certification means that, you've trained and you passed some exam, whatever, in your field.
Mm-hmm.
But a license means that the state says you're legal
right.
to practice, which is a different thing. So, for example, in many states, a doctor can legally practice homeopathy or whatever they want, even if they don't know anything about it, right? So there's several states now working on health freedom legislation, and California was one of the first states to pass it, and actually I was part of the whole movement to do that. I was on the board of the California Health Freedom Coalition, and we passed a law in 2002, went into effect January 2003, that says that as long as the practitioner doesn't do certain, there's various restrictions. We're
right.
not allowed to practice, conventional medicine. We can't, invade the body or
mm-hmm.
Prescribe, prescription drugs or, as long as you're not practicing medicine and you also disclose to your patients that you're not a doctor, and you tell them what you do and your training. You have to give them, a disclosure form, basically. As long as you do all these things, then you can practice legally Yeah.
So how far are you from Sacramento?
Me? Well, I have a, myself have a very small practice. I'm in the Palo Alto area.
Okay.
And I actually only, and people write to me and call me because, you know, my book. And I only have a very small practice, part-time practice of adults only. I don't treat autistic kids myself.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly what I do is, you know, I try to, you know, tell people about my book and sell my book. And I write a lot. I write the Mothering Magazine article. And I also work for the National Center for Homeopathy. I'm on their executive board.
Okay.
So I mostly have devoted myself, I'm not making much money doing this, but I devoted myself to letting people know about homeopathy and you know, doing referrals, especially for autistic kids. You know, I'm sort of been following, I know who the practitioners are out there, especially in the United States, but actually I do referrals all over the world. You know, I just sort of try to provide some guidance and help to people.
Right.
You know, I don't make any money doing it. Maybe I should charge them, but I really, I feel blessed. You know, my family was saved. My kid was saved. Max is now, 14 years old. He's in ninth grade in high school. He's a great student. He's like this, you know, very social kid. He's already on his second girlfriend now. I'm really lucky, and so I'm just trying to give back, that's all. And homeopathy is an amazing thing. I want people to know about it because it can help a lot of people.
So. Well, Amy, it was a joy talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
And people can purchase your book at the impossiblecure.com?
Yeah, it's impossiblecure.com.
Okay.
And if they go to Amazon, you can find it there. If you just type in homeopathy, it's usually like in the top five books. Actually, it's also in German translation, too. If you go to impossiblecure.com, you'll find out everything about it.
Okay.
There's all kinds of information. There's a page on autism, pointer to referral lists, you know, for practitioners. There's just a lot of information. I also have my own radio show, so
right.
People can, and a lot of my shows are archived, so if people listen to those, they can kind of get a little short course on homeopathy.
Oh, I would love to listen to your shows.
Yeah, check it out, because
okay.
It's like a free way to learn more about homeopathy. But
that's great, Amy. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.